Hello, and welcome to AFBT Comics Podcast, episode 64. That's a number that if you spin it upside down, it almost looks like a 494? I don't know. My name is David Brook. I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. How you doing, Forrest?
Hello! My name is Forrest with two R's. I am staying at home. I'm keeping my distance from people, but okay. I am still excited to talk about comics.
Podcasting is, you know, it's like a golden age of podcasting because we need to stay distant from each other right now. So there's more reason to never hang out with people.
All the time in the world to listen to us talk about comics.
In 6 months, I want to know if like the number of podcasts quadrupled or something.
Because people were like, I was asking my wife the other day if she thought there was going to be a baby boom.
Yeah, I've heard people talk about that.
And then we were debating whether or not it would be the opposite because people are trying to limit interaction as much as possible.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So there could be a birth boom or a birth dearth. These are weird times. I didn't get to say much. I was off the show last week.
You were?
I took a much-needed mental health weekend that turned into a really weird weekend. Originally, it was going to be because I was covering Emerald City Comic Con. That's been postponed until August.
Yep.
We'll see if that gets moved again, given the current state of things. I will tell you, I definitely found solace in reading comics this week.
Yes, yes.
Because I needed that, for sure.
Yeah, I was thinking about this last week, like, you know, AFPTcomics.com, it's an entertainment website. Is this really a valid thing that we need right now? And I kind of revolved around it a little bit thinking, oh, maybe not. But then I thought, no, you know, not only writing, you know, articles, but, you know, reading the comics and watching the movies. Mm-hmm. It's like more important than ever.
Totally. Right?
We need this distraction.
I generally think they're a giant, evil, horrible corporation. And I still do. But I was impressed with like Disney putting Frozen 2 out on Disney Plus early.
Right.
Uh-huh. And stuff like, yeah, people need that. People with kids at home definitely need that.
Right.
So that's awesome.
Comixology, I think they're giving out their limited free trial up to like 60 days or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a cool time. People need content now more than ever.
Right. And unfortunately, your local comic shop is a place where you have to convene with other people. So that's been the biggest, I think, development in the news-wise.
Yeah.
Before we get to the news, though, I just wanted to point out, in the show, we have John Allison on. We're actually going to be talking about his new series, Wicked Things. It's a mini-series, a six-issue series. It uses a character that's sprouting from Giant Days. And John is hilarious. We play Super Fight, and he has some really interesting thoughts on the industry in general. If you hold on, you'll get to listen to that interview later in the show. But this is the Comic Book Podcast, where we talk about the news, review some comics, and look ahead to the week ahead. Mm-hmm. So in the news, yeah, a lot of people right now are talking about your local LCS. How are they going to survive if people are, you know, social distancing as they should? And there are a lot of options out there like curbside pickup.
Right. I've seen quite a few pivot to curbside pickup, even home delivery, mailbox delivery, stuff like that. So that's really cool. People that run comic stores are doing so because they like comics. And they like the comics community more than they're trying to, you know, like, make money.
Right.
Because it's not necessarily a money-making industry. So that's very, very cool. I've also seen some put up signs, and I don't want to speak for any LCSs, but probably a good idea to put up signs that say, like, please touch only what you want to buy.
Yeah.
You know?
You can't really Lysol comics. They're paper products, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of them are also losing money on, like the trading card game front. A lot of them have like Magic the Gathering nights or Pokemon nights, stuff like that. You obviously can't have those, or at least for, I live in Washington State, which is the most severely impacted state right now.
Yeah.
And so we have very strict guidelines in place that like you can't have more than 10 people in a location. You can't advertise events to more than 10 people, all sorts of stuff. Our governor has been very, very proactive about it, but it is a weird time, and the impact on LCSs, a lot of them, you know, individually owned or run businesses, is going to be massive.
Right. And that's the fear, right? We talked about this a little bit on last week's show. You know, the industry is very much propped up on comic shops. And if comic shops fail, we have less locations to get comics.
Right.
Mid last week, Image Comics came out and they put out a statement basically saying, y'all, we need to get together and prop up the LCSs. Because they need us more than ever right now. They're going to be potentially, I mean, a lot of these shops, they exist only on a week by week or a month by month basis. Yeah. And, you know, with everyone staying at home as they should, that's a huge amount of sales.
And again, especially, like, I want to say my piece on that is, like, I'm not discouraging that. Stay the fuck home.
Right.
Stay
right,
inside. Exactly. Wash your hands. Stay away from older and immunocompromised people and stuff. But also, figure out if your LCS has ways to get comics to you.
And I mean, on top of all that, like, this is a browsing industry. Like,
right.
You might not read Fantastic Four this week, but you see that there's a new arc. So you pick it up and look at it really quick. And you can't do that anymore, really.
Right.
So Image Comics came out, wrote this letter to retailers, and they basically called out the big two, right?
They did. I mean, that's not the main takeaway for me.
No.
They did say that they're the third in the industry, but it's a big gap between them and number two. Right. And they didn't directly say Marvel or DC or anything. So what they did say, the bulk of the text is what they have put in motion so far. All Image Comics product for first order cutoff Monday, March 16th, and for all following first order cutoffs through the rest of the month are going to be fully returnable. They're also planning on extending returnability into April as needed. They are posting all sorts of social media posts on behalf of direct market retailers, mail subscription deliveries and curbside pickups. So they're doing all that marketing for LCSs when available.
Mm-hmm.
They've emailed 80,000 plus consumers, encouraging them to follow their local comic book stores on social media. So I'm assuming they have some sort of massive list of the social media channels that they work with, or comic stores that they work with. They're pushing for Diamond to extend delayed billing to stores. And they're listening to feedback and concerns and monitoring emails from retailers, Diamond, and consumers. So there's a lot there. They're doing a lot of stuff. And they're really sticking their neck out. I mean, you're looking at, you're saying, hey, every comic that we are not advertising, but not releasing, but just advertising in March is going to be returnable 100%. Right. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of revenue. That's a lot of units.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I mean, let's be honest, they can take the blow and LCSs can't. And that's the whole point, right?
Right, right. And Diamond is also out there helping retailers and helping publishers as well with a lot of changes. So the big news, I guess, is that Diamond is coordinating with publishers. So Diamond is telling retailers, hey, we're working with Image to work on this returnability thing. We're working with Dynamite on their returnability. You know, they are, and we've talked about this before, kind of the one channel for direct market. So right. It's very, very important that they're invested in it. And it seems like they're not forcing their own initiative on any publishers right now, but they are helping publishers with their responses.
You know, it's really good, too, because it's it's waking others up who aren't maybe the sleeping giants out there
right.
to do something about it.
Right.
Right. And then it took 2 days, but 2 days later, Boom Studios CEO Ross Ritchie, he wrote a letter to retailers as well, and he committed to 33% of single issues and 20% of all graphic novels can be returnable. I'm not exactly sure how that math works out, but again, like, trying to make it so that the LCS can still get the book and not necessarily get a hit on it if they can't sell it.
Right, right. Which I think is the core idea behind returnability.
Yeah.
But it's a lot for Dynamite and Image and a couple of other publishers. And again, publishers that aren't the big two to stick their necks out like that.
Other publishers like Aftershock have come out and say they are contemplating delaying some books.
Yes, Vault did too.
Yeah, and I mean, and the idea being, you know, it's kind of not fair to the creators if these books come out and then they bomb, and it's, you know, not because of the quality of the book, because people aren't actually physically seeing the
right
book.
And I tend to perceive those books, the quality of those books, actually as being better than the big two in general. And they, Aftershock and Vault in particular, I don't think are established maybe as much as Image. Right. So they're also looking at their revenue and the fiscal hit that they're going to take and saying, hey, we can't do this. Let's just sell the comics at a later date.
Yeah. When I saw Aftershock's news, I thought, well, they're so small and so relatively new,
right.
You know, they're going to have to just pull the book and wait, because Image can feasibly still put a book out on relatively on time and take a hit if they must. Meanwhile, on Friday, Bleeding Cool had an article with a letter from Marvel Comics to retailers, and in it they talk about how they're going to be giving deep discounts to LCSs for any book coming out between March 18th and April 8th. Kind of an interesting slight tangent to the other publishers in that they're putting a set date on it.
Yeah.
And also the books that already came out this Wednesday, they're getting that discount. So I'm not sure how you could proactively add a discount to something, but they're trying to do their part too.
Retroactively. Well, because I think it's indicated in Image's statement that they are pushing for Diamond to do delayed billing to LCSs.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
So I think some LCSs take stock on credit.
Yeah.
Basically, and then some of it's returnable and some of it isn't in general practice. But they're saying like it's going to be even more lenient right now.
Right, right. One thing in the Marvel retail press thing or letter that they wrote that kind of eased my mind was they said, we are going to continue releasing our books every week. They're not stopping.
I think that
I was worried about that.
I think that that's good. They can soldier through.
Right.
You know, the X-Men books in particular all do really, really well on Comixology every week. Mm-hmm. So I bet that they're even just looking at digital revenue, they seem to be taking like 6 of the top 10 spots every week. So I'm sure that they can sustain themselves on that for a while, to say nothing of the fact that they're owned by Disney.
Right, right. You know, it's crazy. When I was contemplating, like, will they delay books? I was thinking, wait a minute, with Empire coming out. And by the way, Forrest and I are doing a column, Empire State of Mind, every Tuesday, if you want to check that out. Last week we had Tom Brevoort on to answer questions.
In New York.
If you delay Empire, the new summer event.
Jungle.
Which starts April 15th.
Where dreams are made of.
Screwing over all these tie-ins.
Yeah, no kidding.
Imagine the nightmare of trying to figure that out and untangle that.
Yeah, it's a massive... There's like 20 tie-ins for that book. And by extension, that means that there's like 10 editors, however many artists, writers, colorists, inkers. C.B. Cebulski's overseeing all of that, as well as Marvel's response to the COVID-19 stuff. Like, that's massive.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be an NPR at Marvel right now. Your head must be spinning.
Yeah. Shout out Anthony.
Yes, Anthony. One of the main contacts we have at Marvel Comics. So yeah, it's good to see that there is planning taking place. There's discounts taking place. People are considering the LCSs out there. I know LCSs are getting help from their clientele.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that on Twitter. If you check out Twitter, you can probably see a lot of this outreach, which is heartwarming.
I was going to say on Twitter as well, Leah Williams, the Marvel writer, has been doing a really cool thread and also an interactive map, I think. That shows what LCSs across the country are doing curbside pickup and stuff like that. Her ad is My Monster is Chic. And that's been really interesting just to see the community in large kind of respond to it too.
Yeah. It's interesting because the LCSs, they always kind of need help because they're always in danger of this like digital market taking, spacing them out.
I know for quite a few of them too, comics aren't their money maker.
Right.
It may be what gets people in the door, but it's not necessarily what makes them the most money.
Right.
I don't know.
So in reverse of a comic shop, there's a comic book nonprofit that released 400 pages of comics, lesson plans, activities for teachers and caregivers, which is pretty dope.
Yeah, this is really cool. It's a nonprofit called Weird Enough Productions. And the thing that really stuck out to me about it is that they have lesson plans about comics and then also lessons plans about other topics that are taught in a comic form.
Right.
I actually hadn't heard of this initiative before. And that's neither of us has any reason to really look into what youth readers are up to. Right.
Sure.
I checked out their website. I clicked around for a while. And I think it's a really great resource. I've seen like a lot of tweets this week that are like, every parent with their kids home now realizes how much more money teachers should be making.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really neat way to get some of those lesson plans and stuff through to your kids in a format that they want to interact with.
Right, for sure. Yeah. And we just see it's a business that's booming right now and only going to grow even more as time goes on.
Yeah, absolutely.
In our next bit of news, it's positive. Wait, no, it's more sad
it's
news. Free Comic Book Day has been postponed till later this year at a date unspecified.
I guess we could spin it to say not it's positive because it's not canceled.
Yeah, but here's the question. You know the Free Comic Book Day comics have probably already started, maybe even done.
Yeah.
What do they do with those?
Yeah.
Because those are meant to get people interested for comics coming out in the summer or late summer.
And I mean, you're looking at like the announcement of a new character in Venom.
Right.
And stuff like that. So I'm kind of wondering, they might staple those stories to the end of the preceding issue.
Yep, probably.
Yeah.
Yep. And then or at the beginning of the next issue.
Right, yeah. Of like a prologue or epilogue to an issue. And then also do marketing for different things. Because sometimes those free comic book days are a massive channel for a new event or a new writer or something. I remember reading the first... Aaron Avengers on Free Comic Book Day, and the announcement at the end of that one, I'm pretty sure it was that issue, was that Ta-Nehisi Coates was going to be writing Captain America.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
Yeah, which is a huge announcement for them.
I know that was... Was that the same issue where they showed the Ancient Avengers?
I think so,
yeah.
And so that's obviously a lot of marketing tied up in one issue for them. They can't afford to miss those opportunities. It's cool that it's still happening. They'll probably just pivot to different stories.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's really just a way to support local comic shops. And if they're closed or, you know, getting their footing after this all blows over, it's probably best to move this when everyone's happy and willing to be within 6 feet of each other.
Right.
Oh, man, what a crazy time we're in.
It is a crazy time. I did see an interesting thing recommending that people keep diaries to look back on this time.
That makes sense. That's what social media is.
It's my diary. Sure. I delete all my tweets every week or so.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I do.
Clear it out.
Mm-hmm.
You're a new person. You're like cloning yourself.
The born identity.
You want your fresh clone to think that there's a fresh Twitter. I see what's happening. In our next bit of news, Vampire the Masquerade returns to comics at Vault Comics.
Hell yeah! I bet that this has been postponed, but...
Yes.
Yeah.
There are some big names. Tim Seeley, Teenie Howard, Blake Howard, they're all going to be co-writing this ongoing series. And, of course, you were telling me before the show started recording that this is probably a bit of a tie-in.
Yes. There is a new Vampire the Masquerade video game coming out. Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2, which is a sequel to Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines that came out in... God, 2004.
Whoa.
So it's been a really long time. Vampire has had kind of a resurgence as a property at White Wolf is their tabletop RPG publisher. Mm-hmm. And the new edition has been really well received and organized and coordinated and stuff. They had some problems with production content. I think they had some bad editors in place for a while. But it really kind of seems like actually getting behind a new video game has... re-energize the entire brand, which is cool.
Yeah,
because that's one of the greatest role-playing games of all time, and I think it's maybe one of my most favorite settings of all time.
Tell the audience what the setting is.
It is a neo-noir gothic horror world.
Okay.
There are different cults / gangs of vampires running different parts of the country. And across North America, as well as Europe, there are vampires and all sorts of... It's kind of like Underworld.
Okay.
But cool.
Is there less leather?
Yeah. No, there's probably more leather.
Or plastic. What is she wearing there?
Yeah, I don't know. but it's very, very cool. And I really like that they're taking the ancillary, the tie-in stuff seriously.
Yeah.
Like, getting Vault is a show of goodwill, I think. A good understanding of where their product needs to be.
Yeah.
And then also that Vault is reaching out to, like, known goth, Teenie Howard, Tim Seeley. Like, all these people that not only work really well with established properties, but also really well work really well with the aesthetic that Vampire adheres to.
Right, yeah. Like, these Savage Shores had that classic...
Right.
Almost like Bram Stoker's Dracula feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm really, really excited for this. Right now, it's due out in July. I don't know if that will be delayed or what, but I'm gonna be on top of it.
What do you do if, like, in issue 2 of the Vampire Masquerade, you find out that it's the first of a... They're going to make a universe, and these Savage Shores is part of the same world. Like, would you be down for that, or would you...
Sure. Totally.
Would you prefer them to only put out books that are in their own universes?
No, I mean, I would totally be into that. I trust... Vault's creative direction so much, I guess.
Yeah.
And I also feel like Vampyr in particular, as a tabletop role-playing game, it lends itself to that.
All the powers and whatnot.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking of powers, new details have come out about New Warriors, which is a team of multiple characters of a variety of powers. Actually, one of them is called B Negative, who's a vampire, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
Who's like related to... Yeah. I actually stumbled into that. I just happened to click on it. He's got a really cool jacket, by the way. He sucks blood out of his palms like Morbius.
Oh.
Yeah. So Marvel earlier this week released a trailer where Daniel Kibblesmith, the writer, talked about lots of things. The themes, the character names. Forrest is just dying to talk.
I'm not.
So then, like, what was this? Tuesday or Wednesday? I went on Twitter and I sometimes look at what's, like, trending and I'm like, wait, what? Why is New Warriors trending?
Of all things, right.
Like, not only is this, like, a very, like, not very known, well-known comic series from, like, what, the early 90s?
Yeah. No, but, like, I think it's even older than that.
It doesn't even exist, really, in right. the Marvel Universe right now because it's been retired for so long. And I'm like, what's happening? So people are very, very upset. I'm going to just cue right in to the two characters. One is called Snowflake and one is called Safe Space.
I think even worse than that, the Native American character is named Trailblazer.
Yes, there's that as well. There's Screen Time. Let me see.
Screen Time. Man.
That was a weird one. I don't see the picture on our AIPTcomics.com post. If you go to the listing, you can see pictures of these characters. Yeah.
So
there's some problematic things here that we yes. could probably spend an entire show talking about.
Easily. Are you kidding? I could talk into a microphone alone about this for an hour and a half. We talked about it a lot already off air. I think you know my feelings on it. I think anyone that listens to this show probably knows my feelings on it. We're 64 episodes deep, y'all.
Yeah.
It's so disappointing to see two cis men, Daniel Kibblesmith, I can't remember the other author's name right now. I know that other author is queer, so I don't want to say two cis hetero or two cis white men or anything like that, but it is just really like toothless, weak satire that is being, I think, very poorly marketed. I think that especially the names, what is it, Safe Space and Snowflake. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think especially those names, they tend to, stuff like that, trying to reclaim it, especially when it hasn't been leveled against you as a creator as often as it has other people in other groups.
Mm-hmm.
It centers the oppressor. It's literally boiling their names down to what people online would call them.
Right.
Which it puts the oppressor at the forefront of your mind. It puts that toxic culture at the forefront of your mind, comic skaters and stuff like that. And then I think for me too, the marketing decision is just baffling because the, I guess for lack of a better word, social justice crowd is put off by this for the reasons that I am. But then also, the Comicsgate crowd is going to be like, well, this is either pandering too much to us,
right,
or it's pandering too much to the social justice crowd. And so you've effectively alienated both markets. And I'm sure that the folks writing this and the folks that greenlit it are very nice, and I want to believe well-intentioned, but it's just half-baked.
Yeah, I think we talked about it briefly in Slack. It feels like it's potentially two problems. I don't think the intention is in a bad place. I don't think they ever meant to be awful, judging by their careers and their backstory that we know of. But the marketing, it's clearly trying to sensationalize this and get people talking and upset.
Right. And I think that also...
Which is manipulative.
Right. I think it also belies that they don't actually care about these issues that much, so much as they care about the marketability of the issues, which... If you want to talk about the person that has the final say at Marvel, Akira Yoshida,
yes.
No fucking kidding that they would lean that way.
You know, Chris Hassan made a point in Slack that I think he's right about. Like, if it ends up selling well, Marvel's just going to keep making these choices, you know? Because ultimately, it's a corporation, and they're going to act as they see the market act. So if people want to put their money where their mouth is, they shouldn't buy the book if they're upset by it. And that will hopefully steer the ship and make them realize they made a mistake, because I don't think they will otherwise. They haven't put out a statement. And we're recording this on Friday night, so they haven't put out a statement yet, and they're just carrying on, which I think they've done in the past with other times where the people are upset Twitter or social media.
He barely commented on the Akira stuff.
Right.
Yeah, totally. Right. They totally do this. They're a little bit more communicative than DC, but not very.
Right, yeah. They're two very big corporations who are just hoping that it'll blow over and everybody will buy the book and be happy.
to that end, to the fact of this podcast, I feel like it's come up the last couple episodes, which is weird and self-aware, but we're two white dudes with beards talking about comics on a podcast. Like, go to Twitter and see how marginalized people of color, queer people, non-binary people in particular, are responding to this, and read their reasons why. And I think it's all very reasonable and well-founded. And even if they were acting out of anger, they're doing so because this upsets them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's totally justified. There are voices better than us to comment on this.
Do you know if Kibblesmith had commented or anything?
I don't know.
He's very active on Twitter, so if he hadn't, I wonder if, like, Marvel said don't.
I mean, that's possible, yeah.
He seems like the type that would. I was pumped for this until this reveal, because now I'm not so sure. Because, like, first of all, I like Kibblesmith. I thought he did great on Loki. And it looks like the visual style. It's very, like, bright and bubbly, so it looks like it could be a lot of fun. But now I'm realizing it's trying to do this political thing.
It looks like he has not commented on it. Right. They posted the character designs, and that's it.
What would you do if Marvel, like Monday said, we're changing the names and changing the story?
Applaud them, for sure.
Would you be happy? Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw a lot of writers, I saw like Donnie Cates in particular saying like, well, you haven't even read the first issue yet.
Yeah,
and
I said the same thing to you.
Yeah, and you did. Yeah. And my response to that is, if it's satire or it's whatever it is, it has to work outside of context. Otherwise, you're just a dude walking down the street in a Nazi outfit.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like,
Daniel isn't a Nazi.
No. Yeah. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying people levied the same stuff against like Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
And
sure.
If people don't understand it from the outside looking in,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't work.
Right. At face value.
Right.
You know, everyone's up in arms over this on Twitter. And James Tynion, he had a decision to make and he said, let's get off Twitter.
True. Yeah.
People are, you know, have a lot of opinions about Joker and Batman and Harley Quinn, of course. Probably these might be some of the most toxic people on the internet, for all I know. But James Tynion went on Twitter and said, hey, I'm going to start a message board. And he did.
He created a message board. He has his own, like, little business venture that he's been doing small things like this.
Tiny
Onion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this is a fascinating turn of events because I actually talked about this on the show a little bit last week. You know, with these virtual cons coming up because conventions are being canceled. Now we've got James Tynion creating his own message board. We already know creators have their own newsletters. All the creators are like taking the conversation into their own personal realms rather than like requiring or going on like CBR boards and talking to people there, which they probably already do. But what if this kept happening where creators were like, F this, I'm going to make my own message board. Come talk to me there.
I mean, I think it is kind of happening. A lot of creators have their own Discords, too.
Right. Yeah, Stegman, right?
Plenty of people. Ryan Stegman has one for the Stegman and Friends podcast. Lots of people do. And I know that there's even private ones for artists to talk to each other, for writers to talk to each other in the industry and stuff like that, which I'm not saying I have a problem with. But Twitter is such a terrible platform for productive conversation.
Sure.
Like, I think people making good points and people making bad points on Twitter know that. Like, everyone fucking calls it the hell site, right? it's neat to see James's message board. It doesn't look like it's getting a ton of traction.
Yeah, I suppose that's the problem with a creator doing that, right? If they don't have a million person fan base, it may fizzle out.
Yeah, so it looks like there's a total of 17 threads, 168 posts. As I'm looking at it right now, one guest is online aside from me, and 12 members and 21 guests have been onto the board in the last 24 hours, which isn't a lot. It's certainly not as many people as see James's Twitter posts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. I don't know. I do kind of worry that sometimes if you're moving the conversation, I think this is what you're alluding to. If you were moving the conversation to Discord and stuff like that, there's a lot of valuable information that's lost to the general public. I don't want to be, I have Discord. I don't want to be in like 1,000 different Discords for different topics or whatever.
No, see, then a corporation will come and make an app that you can make all the Discords come into one.
Oh, aggregate them into one, right.
And then it's $60 a month, and then eventually it's $200 a month.
Yeah, and I check out the CBR boards from time to time. I check out, like, IGN comments from time to time and stuff like that. I do like Reddit is only good when you use it for hobbies. Mm-hmm. Like, the general Reddit boards are terrible. But if you drill down into specific hobbies, Reddit is a good place to aggregate lots of different conversations like that. So, I don't know. I'm not a real Tinian head or anything. It's interesting.
Tinian head.
It's interesting. John Byrne has his own forum and has had one for, I think, like decades now, where he's been posting what he would be doing with the X-Men right now.
Right.
It's totally like on model X-Men characters in a comic that he updates occasionally. They're just not called their names and it's not called the X-Men.
Right.
And fans are super, super into that. So I do think it's kind of more sustainable for an artist than it is a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting. I don't know how the conversation evolves in a closed space like that. I think it's both better and worse.
Right. You have a danger of siloing your fans, and then
everyone's
telling you you're amazing, and then and then Punchline comes along and everyone's like, wait a minute. DC sent us an early look at Batman number 93, which has a preview of Punchline fighting Harley Quinn. Punchline is the new girlfriend of Joker.
Right.
It is a very TNA heavy fight sequence.
Hmm.
It just reminds me of the 90s. So I mentioned this because maybe Tinian is anticipating some blowback.
Maybe. I think he's already probably exhausted by all the conversation about Punchline.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's conveniently timed for sure.
I mean, he's writing possibly the most popular character right now. So he's obviously getting people from all walks of life.
Right. Yeah. Just like Tom King, I think at some point was like, I'm off this.
Yeah, I think it's a blessing and a curse. It helps your career, but then it really drives you insane.
Yeah.
In our last bit of news, Marvel released their June solicitations. Just curious if there's any surprises you saw. I can go first if you want.
Go for it.
With every Marvel solicitation, a lot of this news was already revealed, like Darkhold from Steve Orlando was revealed.
Fuck yeah, very excited for that.
Jean Luen Liang's Shang-Chi, which we already knew. A lot of Empire tie-ins, as well as Empire 3 and 4 coming out in June. But some of the things that surprised me, because they weren't revealed yet, America Chavez is coming back in a series.
That's very cool.
Very cool. Yeah, I like the character. She's got this portal power that's fascinating. There's a backstory that I highly recommend you checking out. Involving two mothers who are gods. It's a lot to wrap your head around, which is pretty cool. You don't see that every day in comic books. There's an X-Men Dawn of X Saga number 1 coming out book that's basically like an encyclopedic book that writer Jess Harold does.
Yeah, you were telling me that this is the one you were telling me is kind of poorly advertised, right?
The solicitation is just like explaining all the stuff that happens in Dawn of X, but doesn't explain what this book is.
That's a bummer.
And if you look at Jess Harold's work on Comixology, you can see there's like a really cool, it's really well designed internally, the pages for a Black Panther. So like you can get like the 411 on who Black Panther is and a quick history in 32 pages.
Oh yeah, this Jess Harold's work on Comixology is very, very cool.
Also, Infinite Destinies was starting to be hyped in these solicitations, which is running their annual issues starting in June, running through September. So it's sort of like Acts of Evil last year.
Mm.
And Jed McKay is writing the first one, I think, which is Iron Man. Yeah, Jed McKay with Ibram Roberson is doing Iron Man Annual number 1.
Hmm. They're really leaning into Iron Man lately. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
I mean, Iron Man 2020, he's kind of been central. Obviously, he's an Avenger, but he's been central to a lot of events as well.
One might argue that he pops up in Black Widow, the film, which we won't ever see. We've talked about this a little bit. When they do these annual issues, it's interesting how they connect them and if there is a narrative between them. This seems like it's an Infinity Warps type story.
Yeah, I think it tends to be more thematic than anything.
Right. It might be a what if type deal. I don't know. It'll be interesting to track how they pull it off, because these mini events they do sometimes don't pull off so well.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a Silver Surfer Black director's cut coming out.
I really love this behind the scenes stuff. I'll definitely pick up the aforementioned X-Men 1 as well as this director's cut thing. It looks really cool.
Word? Yeah, so if you go to aiptcomics.com, you can check out the full June solicitations. Moving on to top books of last week. What are our favorite books out last week? Well, first we start with comicbookroundup.com to determine what is the overall critic and fan pick, and it's universal between the two this week. The Resistance number 1 gets a 9.8 from critics and a 9.2 from fans. But what is The Resistance, Forrest?
So it is the first book from a new publisher called AWA, which stands for Artists, Writers, and Artisans. It is a publication started by Axel Alonso, former Marvel editor-in-chief. This book, the artist is Diodato and the writer is J. Michael Straczynski. So pulling out the big guns. I held off on reading this book this week, even though J. Michael Straczynski is one of my favorite comics writers, because it is about a global virus.
Yes.
And the response to it. I did see a lot of critics' reviews as well as fans' reviews saying, hey, this book is really, really good. It's not afraid to be political. It's not afraid to get into nitty-gritty issues and stuff like that. And not in like an edgy way. Not in like a, oh, I'm not afraid to get political, you know, in a sincere, well-written, in-depth way, which I would expect from Straczynski. It's just not, I'm not in the right headspace for it right now. It's not their fault. It's also not Donny Cates' fault that he wrote a character named Virus into Venom. This stuff has been in the works for a really long time. So I'm super stoked that people are digging into it. I'm very pro there being more publishers and books out there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. More variety, please.
Yeah, totally.
Speaking of variety, what is your second favorite book of the week?
My second favorite book of the week is Bang, number 2, written by Matt Kint with art by Wilfredo Torres. I really liked the first Bang because it was a send-up of the James Bond archetype. They flip it on its head right at the end. It's still difficult to talk about this book without spoiling it. This one is a send-up of the John McClane archetype. So yes. The guy's literally barefoot. He looks exactly like Bruce Willis. There's all sorts of diehard stuff going on. But there's this really interesting thematic or narrative thread that's being weaved through kind of the first issue and now the second issue, where his entire life is orchestrated in a way, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Like people... Okay. Characters off screen have been sending him drugs that make him super smart, super strong, that kind of stuff. And he's never really questioned it.
Right.
And I think it's interesting to note that he doesn't really know when pressed why he never questioned it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got this really interesting blend of espionage, meta narrative fiction, which, I mean, it's Matt Kint, so that's expected. And then also just really, really well, easy to follow action scene. So I'm really jazzed by it. I like it a lot. I don't know if I was just in the mood for some sort of like meta narrative thing. I also really like Undone by Blood, Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler's send up of the Western genre. So I'm just in this headspace right now, and I think it's really hitting all of its cues in that it gets why people like James Bond movies and like Bruce Willis movies and stuff, but it's also totally making fun of them.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just fun.
It's good.
Right?
It's good.
I'd love to see someone try to pull this off in a movie format.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be like the ultimate action.
I mean, it's kind of the thing that you've always wanted, or like the big fan theory is that James Bond is a code name, right?
Right, right, right.
It is that the comic.
Put that on the cover. Screw you, Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, I was gonna say canoe.
Yeah, because Keanu Reeves has a quote on the issue number 1 on the front cover. That's a pretty good recommendation, huh?
Yeah, maybe they'll do John Wick.
Maybe. My second favorite book of the week was also a fun, you know, popcorn action adventure kind of book. Spider-Woman number 1 by Carla Pacheco and Perry Perez. This is a book that I think a lot of people have been anticipating for a while. They've been hyping this book for months, especially because she has a new costume. It's like mostly black. I think we talked about it on the show
once.
We
did, yeah.
So the whole issue actually has a backup that explains the costume, which is kind of cool. But the main issue is all set on a boat. And Spider-Woman is the security for a very rich man who has a very rich child who is having a birthday party on the boat. And they're, you know, bad guys want to basically kidnap his daughter. And Spider-Woman has to fight them off. And there are little shits on the boat, little kids that are like sexist and ageist. And she actually throws a kid off the boat because he's such a little brat. And I think Carla is infusing it with the right amount of humor, but also letting Perry Perez just like blow us away with the art. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where she dives under the boat and she clings to the bottom of the boat, but it's like she's like hanging upside down.
Oh, that's cool.
And she is. Yeah. But she's under the boat. Anyway, there's a lot of cool visual cues like that. And basically, Spider-Woman's having a terrible time. Like, she's just, like, tired and feels sick. And this is just not what she wants to deal with. And that attitude that she's got, this, like, Jesus, why me, is going on throughout the book. So you feel that humanity in her while she's, like, pulling helicopters out of the sky.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I find Carla's writing very well balanced. A lot of books, I'm like, oh my god, not every page has to be funny, or like, right, not right. every page has to add a new sad thing about this character. Right. Tom King.
Oh, you have something in your throat there.
Sorry, it's just a little bit of the King virus. Carla's writing does all of that deftly. Mm-hmm. That's especially important with a character as well established as Spider-Woman.
Yes, and if you dig the fact that she's a mom, you will really much like this issue.
Yeah,
I'm really excited for it. I haven't been this excited for Spider-Woman since Dennis Hopeless Hallam.
Yeah,
wrote this series. So, moving on, what is your number one pick?
My number one
of the year, of the week,
maybe of the year. We'll see. It is my favorite. I don't know. My number one pick is Alienated Number 2, written by Cy Spurrier with art by Chris Wildgoose. I really like that this took the alienated concept, which is a bunch of kids in a backwater town experience something alien, literally an alien, and strange that changes their life in dark and both exciting ways, and it just blows that concept up. At some point in this issue, the kids pretend to be gods or angels to...
That was messed up.
Yeah, it was really dark. But it was also funny and poignant, and they did so to mess with this, like, basically the school bully.
Right.
And so that's really interesting because you get that initial satisfaction that's like, oh, yeah, this girl sucks. Like, get her, you know? And you can tell that that's the way the kids are feeling with their new powers as well. And then everything kind of melts away, and like you said, you're like, well, actually, this is really messed up.
Right, right.
And both, I think the kids, you see that in the kids. And I like that it's happening almost immediately. I think Spurrier gets across this immediacy of emotions really, really well. Like, you might see them rethinking that in the next issue in a different comic. Right. But it happens almost immediately here. There's this kind of weird, grotesque E.T. thing happening with Chip. The alien, he's getting bigger, he has sharp teeth, he's sharing violent memories with the kids and stuff.
Loves to eat chips.
Right, right. Ate a billion bags of chips. Chris's art is amazing. There's a really amazing middle of the book, two-page splash that's like this pillar of all of the kids' memories stacked on top of each other, and they're kind of centered in it. And one of the kids is like, God, they're too selfish to even notice that my memories are all kind of littered in here. It really gets the title of the book. It really gets at that, like, what alienation feels like, especially in a small town. But it's not going the normal route, I guess. And I really, really appreciate that. I think it's very good.
I was shocked by the plotting of it. It jumps ahead 2 days.
Yep.
And totally spins one of the characters so... we thought was a good person and may not be.
Yeah, more complex than that.
Right. If you give someone power, right? If you give them power, what happens? And, you know, we've seen this story before, but not in this way. I reviewed this for aptconf.com. I dug this issue a lot. Actually, it was my second favorite for a little bit before I read Spider-Woman. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited to see where this goes because it feels like exciting storytelling like that we don't normally see.
Yeah, totally. I'm kind of talking around why it feels that way, but I guess it's just because Spurrier really gets cliques and high school and like how kids talk. It feels so natural to me rather than the like saccharine Coca-Cola commercial Stranger Things thing.
Ghostbusters?
Yeah, exactly. E.T., whatever it is, you know. It's so much more earnest and organic, and it's not afraid to go to the dark places that some of those other properties are.
The dark side. So before I say what my number one pick is, I just realized that every writer of all four books that we picked have been on the show. All
right.
Are we sellouts or do we just like these people?
Man, I wish we were sellouts. I will take your money.
So Carla's on the show, Cy, Matt Kent, and now my number one pick, Plunge number 2 by Joe Hill and Stuart Immonen. I liked the first issue, but I was worried, right? Because it was dense.
Yeah.
It was dense. A lot of dialogue. Kind of slow. Didn't get to the monsters till the very last page. But I even said this in my review of it. I'm excited because now we are ready to see, you know, the horrors come out. And they do in this issue. I don't want to spoil a thing, but what Hill and Immonen are doing with the island itself is cool. If you like Indiana Jones, where like you might go into a cave and see weird things scrawled on the walls and that means something to the bigger picture, you will love this book. There are things like that in multiple places where you're like, wait, what is going on? And there are so many of these little things. When you put them all together, it's so new and original and fresh. It's just like, what? It's not zombies, of course. It's this. Wait, no, it's this. No, it's this. No, it's this. And Immonen gets to stretch his legs a little bit. In the first issue, again, like it was a lot of dialogue heavy scenes, and this time he gets to draw some scary stuff. So yeah, I'm all in on Plunge. I think this is the third time a Hill House comic has become my favorite of the bunch after having a favorite of the bunch. My last favorite was Lolo Woods, but this one's taken the top spot.
Yeah, I think that they're doing a lot of really good stuff with that.
Yes, they are. In our next segment, top books for next week, we're going to pick our number one book we're looking forward to out March 25th, 2020. This just
ended. Man, you know what one of my goals for quarantine should be? What's that? I'm going to plug that soundboard into this podcast.
Oh, you're going to do the jingle?
I'm going to do the jingle. I'm going to get other sounds in here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Every week now, we're going to talk about our clunkers of the week, and I'm going to cue it in with a toilet flushing sound.
Okay, all right. We should do an episode like that, at least one.
Like a wacky radio show?
Yes. Because it's so, like, manufactured and false.
Yeah.
What is your most anticipated book on it?
My most anticipated book is actually a collected edition from DC Comics. I was wondering if it was cheating.
No, I've done it before.
It's Batman Creature of the Night, written by Kurt Busiek with art by John Paul Leon. I love Kurt's take on classic characters. Untold Tales of Spider-Man is one of my most favorite Spider-Man comics of all time. Creature of the Night is another kind of like Untold Tales, sordid past, unseen history book, but it's about Batman. Few people get why Batman is scary and why Batman is also impactful, as well as Kurt does. I would say he's rivaled only by the likes of like maybe Warren Ellis. And so this book is really, really cool. It took a really long time to come out. I think that there were at times up to like a year delay between issues. That may be, I'm pretty sure that's right.
I think two issues came out, and then there was a huge delay on one.
Yeah.
I can't remember how many issues it was. Was it three or four? Or
five? I think it's five issues, and then I think that there's also back matter in this collection. So,
nice.
Yeah, it looks neat.
Yeah, I reviewed a couple of them, but then, like you said,
right.
It was such a delay that I didn't know if I could review the next one because I hadn't read it so long. Yeah. My most anticipated book out next week is Exo Manowar number 1 by Dennis Hopeless Hallam and Emilio Lizzo. This is a book I got to read extra early because Valiant was like, hey, we want your opinion on this. So I read it, and it's a really good buddy cop action book. It's actually, it's funny that Hopeless is writing, or Hallam is writing this, because it feels like a Marvel book in the Valiant universe, which is pretty cool. Obviously, oh, it's Gizmo. What is it? I know. So the guy in the suit has this, the suit is talking to him all the time. So there's like this buddy cop feel because they're kind of communicating with each other, and that works really, really well. The art is very splashy. And I think people who like action comics are really going to dig it.
Mm.
Like me.
Cool.
I dug it.
This week we cheated by listening to comics we've already read.
Makes it easier on us, doesn't it? In our next segment,
Judging by the Cover Junior,
we are going to pick our number one cover art. Number one cover art that comes out next
the
week.
The most goodest of cover comic.
I always word things weird, and I'm 64 episodes into this. I can't do it. So this is our chance to give the cover artist a little cred, because they deserve it. My pick was X-Men number 9 by Lionel Francis Wu. This cover looks like it could be a poster in a movie. It's epic. It's really cool how he stacks the characters, stacks ships. There's a lot of characters on this cover.
Yes.
There's people bursting out of this like tapestry. I don't know what the tapestry is, but it's kind of cool. It adds like a 3D effect. I love how Cyclops is like doing the muscle arms thing with Jean and Havoc in front of him. What is the deal with Cyclops lately? He's just like always like chill and like happy.
Yeah, they kind of inverted the character in an interesting way that still feels authentic, I guess.
It does. Yeah, for sure. Brew is on the cover. He's awesome. Yeah, just a really, really cool cover how it's laid out. What is your favorite cover?
My favorite cover is Killing Red Sonja number 1. I don't know what I thought it was. Killing Red Sonja number 1, cover art by Christian Ward. Christian is probably the best comics artist or covers artist in the biz. This one is really cool. It does a ton of stuff with Native Space. So there's a giant red, like dripping blood material kind of going down. And then it's draped around a child who's drawing X's over the eyes of Red Sonja. The red also works as her hair, of course. And then it even looks like she has a little bit of a slit throat. I like the texturing on this. It's got like chalk. It's got like splatter, normal line work, and then it's also got some kind of like oil paint buildup across it. So it's very, very textured for an otherwise kind of simplistic cover. I think it looks really good.
Yeah, there's also like a space thing going on at the top.
Yeah, that splatter there. I don't know if that's thematically appropriate or not, or important or not.
I anticipate that KRS is going to be a huge hit.
Yeah.
And then people are going to be calling it KRS. That's it for that segment. In our next segment, John Allison is going to be on to answer questions about Wicked Things, about world building, about detective storytelling, about the comics industry, about what he wanted to be when he grew up, about, you know, what is he reading right now in comics. Silver Surfer Black is on that list. And we also play Super Fight, and we're going to find out what he's into that's not comics related. So check that out.
Wicked, wicked.
So on with us is John Allison. You are the writer and creator of Giant Days, among many other things. And we have Wicked Things number 1 coming out this week from Boom Studios. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So I have a feeling everyone loves a good whodunit. I mean, Knives Out just came out, blew everyone away. What are some of your favorite detective stories? And were there any you read or watched to prepare for Wicked Things?
I didn't specifically watch stuff. I think I'd been developing it for a while. So I did a series about 5 years ago. It wasn't even a series. It was like a webcomic series. So it shaped up to being like one 40-page one-shot called Murder, She Writes, and which was Charlotte, who at the time in the Bad Machinery comic that she originated in, was about 13, I think. And so this was like a one-off story where I studied Agatha Christie stories and like the sort of the closed, like Knives Out, the sort of closed house where everybody is assembled in the room at the end. And I attempted to write a story that way. I gridded it all out, worked it out. And so that was kind of the initial inspiration for taking the character in this direction. And then I didn't do another story in that mode for a really long time. Mm. So that was kind of the initial, Agatha Christie was the initial inspiration. I like the solo sleuth. And then I'd always really enjoyed cop shows as well. So I wanted to do something that kind of mashed those two things into one another. And this is kind of the result. Now, I like American cop shows. I like NYPD Blue and Homicide: Life on the Streets, the kind of ensemble character shows rather than the procedurals. Although I enjoyed those too, but mostly as a sort of technical
thing. Right. Get a little bit dry.
Yeah, a little bit dry. That's the best way of describing them. Yeah.
Age seems to be quite a factor in Wicked Things. I don't want to spoil anything, although this will be posted the Sunday after it comes out. But if you had to pitch Wicked Things to an 18 or 19-year-old person, how would you describe it?
It's a story about somebody who decides, who on the brink of college, doesn't get to go to college and is forced into a workplace. Mm-hmm. That's what it is, really. You know, it's the other path. The other path that, you know, let's face it, probably, I don't know what percentage of people take, but that's what the story is.
Right.
However, it's couched in the most bizarre style possible. I say it's a really tricky story to talk about because I don't want to do too many spoilers.
Right.
Full of them. But that's it, really, except, you know, it's a teen detective. She's meant to be going to college. She gets derailed on the brink of kind of going to become an adult the way that, you know, high achieving kids usually do. And she ends up in a very mixed workplace, which is, you know, the police station. How she gets there is part of the fun.
I don't want to spoil it either, but the awards ceremony in the first issue struck me because having won an Eisner, did you approach the story in the first issue with your own experiences with award shows or the Eisners for that matter?
Well, I'm sort of fascinated with award shows. Having been to one, I lost at the Eisners a few times before I won, and I was there one year when I lost. And I don't know if I'm throwing daylight upon magic here. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I was nominated in one of the very last categories to be awarded. And you could see by the number of trophies they'd racked up in order, because they were all along the back of the stage, you could see who'd won. And I was the only person who was the one person who worked on that book. And there were three in my position. So I knew I'd lost, and I then sat there for 2.5 hours knowing that I'd lost.
Yeah.
And so that was an unusual experience because you're there kind of like, hooray. Like I was pleased to clap for my friends and everything and sure. Whoop when I heard the name of someone that I knew because it's very important to. But at the same time, I really had to do that kind of Oscars pretend you're pleased somebody else won first. Yeah. And I had 2.5 hours to prepare for it. It was a very strange experience. Yeah, so that's been on my mind ever since it happened, really.
I can only imagine when someone else wins in your category, you're like, oh my God, are people looking at my face? Do I smile? Am I smiling?
Yeah, you have to be a good actor. Like I was an actor on stage when I was at school. So obviously I'm as good as any method actor. I'm as good as Brando. And so I can pretty much pass off, you know, the illusion of being delighted while secretly being deeply pissed off. You know, it's like that's the magic of the stage. You know, I'm just bringing it home. yeah, so that's it. So awards ceremonies, but also my girlfriend is a music journalist, and over the course of the 9 years we've been together, she's covered many, many awards ceremonies, mm-hmm. and so she comes back with all kinds of anecdotes from these things. So it's a vivid thing for me, the award ceremony in different ways.
I can tell from the first issue, just the way you laid out the award ceremony, the pressure on Charlotte, the experience of like showing all of it was, it just all felt so much like it was based on reality, and it made it, it informed, I felt, the story so that it really made it feel genuine and real. I love that part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself immersing myself in some really weird things in order to get a bit of authenticity into it. In fact, research is horrible. I want to do a comic that doesn't require any research. Because having to spend two hours, I once had to read about autoclaves for an hour for the sake of one page just to make sure that a science lab actually worked like a real science lab because I'd written the word autoclave in the script.
Interesting.
And I thought, well, I better get this right, hadn't I? What is an autoclave? It's what you boil your your like scalpels and things in your test tubes. Yeah. But, you know, this is a part of daily life for someone who works in a lab, and it's a sort of drudgy job for like the younger employees. So I thought, well, I better know how it works. Oh, I was lost in the world of autoclaves.
Jeez, yeah, I can imagine. And there's like a deep fear that a fan or a reader will call you out, I suppose.
Well, yeah, like a bit of authenticity is a bit of added value for someone. Yeah. Like if someone reads who works in a lab, I always wanted to have like the right sort of thing. So I just give reference to the artist, like, yeah, this is what they'd have. And someone would look at it and go like, yeah, that's right. Because when you watch Star Trek and you see like a 3D printer that they've used for a replicator, you're like, I know what that is. It's taken me out of it for a second.
Right.
So I like a little bit of authenticity. It's like how in movies with comic books in, they, if they've used Comic Sans as the font on the page, even if they've got someone like, you know, Tim Sale to draw the page and they put Comic Sans on it, you're like, yeah. Well, that's destroyed it for them. All your hard work completely ruined because you couldn't go on Blambot and find the appropriate font.
You know, you're reminding me, I think, I can't remember which sci-fi movie it was, but like a character had a costume that was basically made up of parts like a toilet seat and like tubing that you would use in your house, but it was just all spray-painted bronze.
Yes, yes.
Speaking to like your attention to detail, one thing I really loved in the first issue was little details like the text on the magazine. There's a candy that Charlotte's eating and the text on that. And I was just curious, are these things that you write right into the script or do they evolve when you get the art back?
When I was doing my original webcomic, Scary Go Round, I wasn't the greatest artist, but I was working using software that meant that I could use my layout skills from magazines. So whenever a magazine appears in one of my comics, I like it to look like a real magazine. So I actually laid out the cover of that on like desktop publishing software.
Oh, that's
and then
so cool.
I gave that to Max to kind of trace and use. But Max is as detail focused as I am. So like the bag of Haribo sweets that Charlotte's sitting on the train. I just said that that's what they were, because just Charlotte just likes eating sweets. And in other stories, she's had like a big drawer full of chocolate and things like that. And Max gave it like the full detail when, to be honest with you, most cartoonists would just have written the word Haribo on it as an absolute maximum. And that would kind of be it. So, yeah, I think we're both slightly sort of graphic detail obsessed when it comes to brands and things and getting them right.
Yeah. Yeah, it adds a layering to the story that, again, it's like a level of like realism that you don't normally see in every comic. Which I appreciate. Moving on to the lead character, Charlotte. I think she was first introduced in Scary Go Round. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the estate story, which I think came out January 2009.
Yes.
I bring up the year because the timing is important to this question. So the character is 19 years old, I believe, in Wicked Things now.
Yeah.
She's technically lived in reality, in our reality, for 11 human years, if I'm doing my math right.
Well, yes, that sounds right to me, yeah.
So for a character like Charlotte to live inside your head, and we've seen her in Giant Days, and we've seen her pop up here and there, has she changed at all in your perception of her since her creation 11 years ago?
Well, there's a good Charlotte introduction fact, which is that she wasn't in the original script on the page. I just thought it looked a bit empty. So I drew, she was walking with her sister on the very first panel I drew her. And in the original comic, it's just Esther and Sarah, who both appear in Giant Days, just talking to each other. And I thought, no, this is a bit flat. And so I just drew her in there. Yeah. It's a bit of a lark. And then that's how much thought I put into her creation. But she just wrote herself. Like, the speech bubbles seem very natural.
Interesting.
And it was just like, oh, this is. So the character just kind of came to life. And she's just evolved through the Bad Machinery stories.
Mm.
As I sort of perceived she would. It was like, it was good, you know, characters that work are like gold dust, really. And they just kind of, they move of their own, at their own pace. And you can sort of see their arc. Like a lot of characters, you can draw someone. It's like when we start off, we all draw like characters. You're a kid, you draw like a superhero. He's got like a visor. He's got like one wing and like a hand that's a gun. He doesn't really have any arc to his life. He's just got a hand that's a gun. But as I spent longer sort of developing characters, some of them would just come to life. And Charlotte was like that. So I didn't plan. I had no Bible where I said, she's going to look like this at this point. Mm-hmm. She's going to be like this at this point. I could just sort of see that somebody who was like that when she was 8 or 9 would be like this if everything went in a certain direction when she got sort of 18, 19. Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's just kind of there's a lot of machinery in my head that I don't understand anymore because I spent so many years writing stories. My subconscious does so much work that I sort of can't stop it doing things without my permission.
Yeah, I've seen like Stephen King say, like, it just comes out of thin air. I don't know where it comes from. And that makes sense the way you described it.
You've just spent a lot of time doing it, really, and so you, the part of the things that will be at the front of your brain are no longer at the front of your brain. You've done them so many times they've become instinct and they're just kind of ticking away all the time,
right? It's like fight or flight or something. It just happens.
exactly it's the reptile brain, the lizard, yes, storytelling, yes. Brain.
That little piece of brain is doing all the action. One thing that occurred to me while reading the first issue, when you're crafting like a murder mystery detective story, is it difficult to do any world building, for instance, since it might be a touch harder when the audience is focusing in on the detective elements and like the little details that might add up to figuring out what's happening, who's the culprit, all that?
It's nightmarish doing world building. World building is the most important part of like the way I make comics.
Yeah.
So the more plot devices you stack on top of it, the harder the world building gets, because you haven't got space for the sort of easy interactions that expose the world that's around them. You have to kind of almost like shove bits of world building down the side, like you'd shove things in a cupboard. If you're just trying to like force like a cardboard box you want to keep in there, you've got to like shove it down the side where you've got all your, you know, your skiing equipment or whatever. It's like that. You've got to force the world building in, and it is really hard. I did struggle a little bit, but I tried to look at TV shows that did both well. The show that did it best, world building and a case, ever, it was Fringe. The J.J. Abrams, yeah. X-Files.
Yeah, yeah, the sci-fi show. Yeah.
I've watched it a number of times. I've been rewatching the fourth season recently to try and work out how, in the space of 41 minutes, because the episodes get sort of truncated as the seasons go on. It starts off and you get 50 minutes an episode, and it gets down to about 41 when it's obviously not doing as well,
right,
in the rating. And it's like, still, they get a case in, and they get the kind of interpersonal stuff in, and a lot of the world building has already been done by the fourth season, so I'm just trying to work out how they coexist and how they do it. And it's the tightest exercise. I've never seen anything like it. It's such a study in how you get all these things in together. But the thing in the end I had to do was to split the stories in Wicked Things between two issues. Mm-hmm. So in Giant Days, a story was an issue. Even if there was an overriding plot arc, a story was per issue. But in Wicked Things, it's every story gets two issues, because that way you can do your world building, you can get your case in, and you can, you know, deal with plot.
Interesting. So yeah, so in chunks of two, because it is a six-issue series, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So in chunks of two, we'll get both as we progress. That's interesting.
Yeah, in a satisfying way, because I could have got it all into single issues, but it would be so tight that you can't do everything that you want to do, and it doesn't feel as rich.
Right. Pacing is so huge in comic storytelling. I think if it's off at all, the reader is kind of confused or tired of something, or bored, or too excited.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard. Like, most comics are, 20 pages long? And if in a superhero comic, you've barely got space to do anything because there's so much exposition and plot.
Before we jumped on here, I was looking at a website. I'm not sure if you're aware. There's a Tackleford Wikia?
Yes. Oh, yes, I've used it when I can't remember.
It's fascinating, and I was looking all through it. I couldn't stop myself, and I was just like reading all these pages, and it's quite impressive that you've created this universe, this multiverse. I don't know if you call it that, but a universe of characters and places and like a timeline. With that in mind, the multiverse, it seems to be something that we see more and more of these days. For instance, like Joe Hill and Stephen King are kind of weaving their stories in with each other. Are there any inherent pros or cons to building a universe of characters, would you say?
The pros are that it's like a garden, and you can, it's like, instead of having to go to the store to buy beans, you're always growing new beans, you know, and you can plant things, and it doesn't matter if, you know, seeds are cheap.
Yeah.
Whereas going to the store and buying, you know, a celeriac and not liking celeriac, for example, it's going to cost you, you know, it's going to cost you a few pounds, but if you just able to like develop it, it's like a seed bed for all your different ideas at a universe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I could introduce characters, maybe they'd fly, maybe they wouldn't. And it was just part of having a long running, ongoing, open-ended series. It just opened up like a tree, you know, it just spread out like branches. I wasn't disciplined at the start, and that meant that I created something sprawling. I didn't think this is going to be sprawling. It just became sprawling by dint of me kind of developing ideas in quite a frugal way. So, you know, I'd only do a few weeks on one character and there'd be lots of different stories. It was quite scattershot. Mm. I'm more focused now than I was. And I'm keener to kind of keep things tight because I can see the value of that, tight and finite. But the universe is, and it just makes things easy for you. But also with so much entertainment, it allows, you know, there's buy-in on characters,
right,
from the audience. And so especially if you're getting older and perhaps your audience is aging with you, they're more conservative in aging audience, generally speaking. So then they haven't got as much time to develop relationships with new properties and new characters. But if you can give them something they recognize, you've done the homework for them. You've done the hard reading for them. They can just start on page one and they know about it. I'm in two minds because I don't think you should let your brain get so non-plastic that you can't take on new things. You should constantly be trying to expose yourself to difficult or at least new things. Right. So I'm in two minds about whether it's a good or a bad thing. So the cons are, once it gets long in the tooth, sometimes I'll see readers explaining to newer readers who characters are and what they are, and I cringe. I'm pleased that they love it so much that they've learned all this, but it's like, don't tell a new reader this. I work really hard that new readers can kind of jump on and not have to worry about history, but it makes it look like a nightmare. It looks like something where you've had to have done your homework.
So right. Now there's like a learning curve to get into your stories, potentially, if some people are worried about that.
Exactly. And I write everything. Like, Wicked Things is written as if you never read any of my other comics, it doesn't matter. You can start on page one and it's like a new series. It's hugely important because any time you say to someone, this is hard, you're probably costing yourself a sale.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's fascinating you brought up the fact that you have an audience that potentially is getting older. A story on NPR recently was talking about crystallized intelligence versus fluid intelligence and how once you reach like a magic number of like 62 years old, your memory and your ability to learn new things drastically reduces. And in this story, they basically said, if you get to this age, it's best to become a teacher or a writer who teaches others.
Oh, I can absolutely believe that. I know how much harder it is now just because you're not in a huge social group the way you are when you're at college or at school. Your focus becomes tighter. It becomes around the family unit. You know, your horizons are narrower unless you're in sort of special circumstances. Once you get into your 40s, you kind of can't help it. So you've not got as much feeding in, not as many tributaries feeding into the river anymore, if you like.
The mind tributaries. I love it.
Yeah.
Do you have a name for your universe? Because I've seen Tackleverse and I've seen Bobbinsverse.
No, because I don't like to acknowledge that it even exists. I'm pleased. No, not. I don't mind you acknowledging that it exists, but if I were to march into a room, put my hands on my hips, spread my feet into like the kind of male power position, say, guys, I want to talk to you about my universe. I hope someone would shoot me.
That's really a great icebreaker. Right there.
Hey, guys, do you want to talk about my universe for a bit? Yeah. I've got this universe. I've been working on it for quite a while now.
Oh, man.
Some call it a multiverse. Others prefer to think of it as a cinematic universe. I just call it my universe. No, I just can't think that way. I'm just telling stories. And if they're linked to each other, it's the same way that, you know, your story is linked to your next door neighbor. And maybe once in a while, you know, you meet in the hallway outside your apartment.
Right, right.
You know, I don't think, yeah, you know, it's just all concurrent, because what's the point of me making two planet Earths?
No,
Might as well just stick to one planet Earth, you know, it gets too complicated otherwise.
Correct me if I'm wrong, is Steeple not, it's not in, amongst these other characters, like, it's not in the same, I know you just said you don't want to say it's a universe, but it's not in the same realm, is it, or is it?
Well, it's in England.
Yeah.
If Shelley Garam was to go on vacation to Cornwall, then she could meet those characters, but I think it would be, what's the word I'm looking for here, harmful. It would be harmful to the nascent Steeple comics to have characters from those other stories come into it, because immediately it would sort of cheapen their stories, which haven't been around for as long.
Gotcha. Could you ever imagine creating an entirely new not universe, but a series of books that potentially comics that would potentially be in a different realm entirely, outside of England, maybe.
Well, I think I've done a comic set in America, and that was one of the hardest things I ever had to do, and I still don't really know why I did it, to be honest with you. But again, that's still part of the same universe. They just can never meet because they're never going to bump into one another.
Right.
I think that's important. But no, I could do like a fantasy realm, and I think as I get older and I reach the age of 62, and my brain, my intelligence is no longer fluid, I'm going to be existing almost exclusively in fantasy realm. So I would imagine that, you know, my kind of Headlopper style series.
Yeah,
You know, will not have any chance to touch the worlds, and I'll set it on a different planet or something. I can't wait to get to 62 and find out what's going to happen. To be honest with you, I think my brain's going to be in a very poor state by that point.
It'll just be like turning on a light. Something will just click.
I can't wait. I go to bed when I'm 61. I'm like, right, it's all good ideas. Can't wait to get to work on these tomorrow. I wake up the next morning and I've just got like a dunce cap on. I'm like, well. Oh, well, time to go to the fantasy realm.
Someone from the government comes with your dunce cap and just hands it to you at the front door.
I assume so. I assume he puts it on. It's like the BFG. He comes to the window at night and just like pops it on your head.
You are anointed. 62.
62.
Congratulations. Well,
happy birthday to me.
So as originating as a webcomic creator, are there elements of the webcomic creation you miss and things you're happy to leave behind from that realm?
Yes, there are things that I miss and there are things that I'm happy to leave behind. The things that I miss, I think I treat webcomics as a sort of separate from comic strips in a newspaper, because you could go backwards, so you could always read the page before. Mm-hmm. But also I liked a complete unit because the page would be on the front page of the website for a day. So I liked to sort of do a hybrid of a comic strip and a comic page, where you got a satisfying experience on one page and you knew you could go back. And that's something I miss. And I'm actually doing some new Steeple pages just to kind of promote the trade coming from Dark Horse. I'm doing an extra story that I'm just running as a webcomic, and I'm using that format again. So I missed it enough that I could have taken those pages to Dark Horse, but I thought I'll do something using the webcomic format and just kind of use this time to develop the characters further.
Oh, cool. Where can readers find that?
I hope readers like bespoke domain names, because it's steeple.church.
Okay. Nice.
I was very pleased. I love those new top level domain names. You can really have some fun. they're all money laundering exercises from what I hear.
Basically.
So that was what I missed, was that format that I'd worked in for a really long time. I find it very satisfying. I really enjoy pages that work as a unit as well as being part of a larger whole. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I don't miss is that it's frontier country. You know, you're working for yourself. It's quite grinding, and you've got to put a page out to schedule, whatever the schedule you can manage is. And I like to do a page every day, but that's hard work.
Right.
Like five a week was a bit of a killer in the end, because as your standards go up, you're trying to refine your craft, but instead you're just kind of on a treadmill.
Right. There's a danger of it becoming like a factory operation, I would imagine.
Yeah. And there were definitely times where it did become like that. Again, you had to find ways to work past it being a factory operation. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And also, yeah, you know, the buck stops with you. You've got no one to tell you that you're doing it wrong, but also you've got no one to help you when you're struggling. So that was the thing I didn't like about being webcomic in the end. As I got older, I was worn out from doing it by the time I started doing print comics to a greater extent.
It seems like with like Reddit or other social media platforms, folks are quite inclined to steal webcomics and not even like leave the creator's name on it these days too, I've seen.
Oh, sure. There's a culture like webcomics. It's just another media where people kind of gave away too much, really, and then kind of stayed at it a little bit too long. So, you know, people think of those things as free. It can't help it. If you were born in the year, you know, 2003, you've never known another world where comics weren't basically like free like water if you wanted some. So I can't blame too much. You know, no one's ever told them different, really. We set the example. That's by true. Giving away them for free.
That's interesting. When you were little, what did you think you'd be when you grew up?
That's an interesting question. I had great angst about what I would be as an adult. So I sort of gravitated towards vocational careers. At first, I was going to be a lawyer. This is when I was about 14. Yeah. Then I realized how many books you had to read. Look at that. What a memorization. Yeah. So then I studied to be a journalist. And even when I was like a teenager, I was making zines and things. So I was kind of always working towards that. I don't think that counts as little. When I was little, I thought I was going to be a cartoonist. I was drawing hell of, you know, Transformers comics on the back of old, you know, Kleenex boxes and stuff.
Yeah.
I was just going mad making comics. Yeah. So in the end, it all worked out.
It did. So that was your earliest career aspiration?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as I saw it and sort of realized that, you know, you just started pushing the pencil around on the page and create a little narrative, that was kind of... Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to do.
I like asking that question because I'm so surprised by the response. Like, Seisberger was like, oh, I haven't grown up yet, so I'll let you know, something like that.
I was born at 40. I was very goals orientated as a child. I had a very sort of somber picture of my universe, even as a kid.
Oh, man, I'm sure that informed your comedy.
Yeah, exactly. And now I've kind of aged to about the age in my brain I was when I was, you know, 11.
Yeah,
it's quite strange. I was like, I was expecting these new fields to open up of maturity. It's like, no, effectively the same kind of modern attitude towards, you know, people messing about. Just don't like it. Come on, guys, you know, be a bit more serious. Come on, think about what you're doing.
That's funny. I don't know why my brain goes to like cat years, dog years, and now there's John Allison years where you're kind of going back a little bit, but you're still progressing.
Exactly. I'm going to look very foolish by the time, you know, I'm in my 70s. And he's like, well, he's still the same. He's still effectively doing what he wanted to do when he was about 11, with the same attitude to things as he had when he was 11, slightly too serious about it. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to change this. But I think I'm just an epoch. I think I'm just like one kind. I'm like the Anthropocene, you know.
It's
There's not enough years in a human lifespan to, you know, encompass the epoch I'm apparently trying to create for myself.
Nice. Getting back to some serious questions here.
Sorry about that.
No, of course not. What do you hope to see in the comics industry in the future?
Now, this is, again, survival. That would be my first thing. But also, but I say that in terms of, obviously, yeah, this week, yeah, you think, yeah, survival, because comic shops aren't open. Obviously, I want, but if you disregard that and accept that people are going to want comics, even if entirely new orders have to spring up because a few players fall by the wayside, I think comics have a way, American comics have a way of kind of closing the door on people just by the fact that Marvel and DC books are so hard to approach. Mm-hmm. They're drawn in a way that isn't particularly appealing to, in some cases. I have to be very careful how I say this, because when I look at the big wall of new releases in the comic book store, there are always books I want to look at, but the stories are hard to approach and a lot of the art is alienating, especially if you didn't grow up with comics, because they're kind of designed for a mature version of people who read them as kids.
Interesting.
So just broader and more diverse work, and there's a lot of work appearing in that direction, but just an acknowledgement that if you want to get people reading comics, you have to get everybody reading comics, because you're not going to be able to rely too much longer on the kind of dyed-in-the-wool 70s, 80s fan who's, you know, by making comics, kind of like twisting them into something that's acceptable to them. I know, I respect the guys who work on those books enormously. I think they're chops and their knowledge is incredible, but I don't think the companies who make those comics are serving future audiences or even the current audience very well. But then there's loads of good stuff as well, so perhaps it was ever thus. So yeah, that's what I want, just more diverse books, really, in terms of storytelling.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because like DC's trying to do more middle grade books of late, and maybe they're trying to steer the ship in the right direction, because what you said, I've never heard that point you just made, which is like, the big two are kind of making comics for the 30 or 40 somethings who grew up with them, but now they're aged up for that age. That's interesting.
It doesn't, you know, they've just made like the storylines, they're storylines about characters for kids, but will just convolute the storylines, fold them in on themselves over and over again. You add the kind of weird wrinkle of like DC's constant sort of universe evolution to try and straighten out something which can't be straightened out because it's insane.
Yeah.
And then they're drawn like that sort of, that point where kind of Brian Hitch, who again I think is an amazing professional, but became like the benchmark for the level of realism that went into comic art, made it impossible to draw these books to a schedule, because it's you know, drawing every stitch on every boot or whatever.
Right.
It's not sustainable. Look at how Walt Simonson drew a comic, you know, or Sal Buscema. Yep. These guys were fast artists, and they had somebody to ink them as well, you know, in a lot of cases.
Right.
And now you're asking professionals, incredible working professionals, to do basically perform miracles on, like, you know, 1989 money. Well, I don't think that's actually sustainable as a business model, because people are going to get better jobs in video games eventually, unless they really, really, really love comics.
Right.
So I don't know. I worry for the industry just because it all seems to be, or the US industry at least, because it all seems to be geared up towards like sort of a customer base who really they're quite mercurial. Mm-hmm. And then they're not open to exploring stories, whereas kids, you can give kids the most convoluted plot line imaginable. Yeah. They'll accept anything and they'll study it and they'll read things six times. Whereas you're making comics for adults. Adults don't have time to read things six times. They barely understand what you're giving them unless they've been reading for a really, 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 really long time. I don't see how that works. I don't see how that works long term.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem, especially with Marvel or DC events, because it's not only requiring you to know the history, but know the recent history, and not on top of that, all the tie-ins that conform the story.
When I look at the industry, it looks mad to me. Like I say, I'm not reading Marvel and DC books all the time. I might pick up the odd one that a friend's working on or an artist I really admire. Like I love, like, Chris Samnee would be a good example. I always want to see a Chris Samnee book. It's beautiful artwork.
Of course, yeah.
You know, or if like Becky Cloonan's working on something, you know, that maybe I pick up an issue just to see what she's doing. But the stories are often, they don't make sense to me. So I'm kind of alienated from it by that. So,
learning curve.
It is that the learning curve's enough. And those books are pricey, you know. Again, if you're only going to sell to these hardcore readers, you can't charge what a 20-page comic should cost.
Yeah.
Like we know in our heart of hearts, that's comics' dirty secret, that $4 for a 20 page story.
Yeah.
It's loopy, you know?
Yeah, because we all grew up with $1.95 comics.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they were pocket money purchases for kids, not discretionary purchases for adults. No, it doesn't. That's not an industry that makes sense to me. But there are so many ways that it could be fixed. You know, it's just going to take a bit of a brain's trust and a few good ideas, because people love the medium. They just enjoy picture stories. You know, look at how many kids read those Raina Telgemeier books.
Right.
You know, people love comics, or Hilda, things like that.
What's wild is we talk about the sales every month, once a month, of course, on the show, and like the $9.99 Detective Comics, the $10 Detective Comics number 1000, Wolverine number one was $8. That was number one on the list. These books that are supposedly, you know, iconic for being number one or reaching a milestone issue end up being a fortune.
Yeah, the $10 comic, well, again, but it's easy. $10 to an enthusiast is nothing. Like, what would you spend on a sandwich? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, perhaps a nice beer in a bar, you know, $10.
Right.
It's entirely possible, isn't it?
Right.
It's a discretionary purchase. It's like, yeah, that's what I'll have instead of having three beers, I'll have two or whatever. Your brain doesn't even make the calculation if that's the thing you like, you know. But it's not a purchase for a member of the public. That might be the best comic ever made, but you look at it, and how many pages are there in one of those $10?
I think usually about 80, maybe 90
so
pages
like
max.
An old annual.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of makes sense. But again, it's a lot of money for a kid. It's a lot of
people who
don't know that they're going to like it, you know, and I don't even know if those books are designed for kids to read in the first place.
You make a good point, because there are times where I'll go to the supermarket and I'll be like, oh, I have a coupon for $1 off this can of beans. But then I will go to a restaurant and I will pay $17 for a burger because it looks so good.
Exactly. And those are like adult decisions. Yeah, those are the decisions we make where it's like, well, I work hard for a living. I've kind of earned
And
this kind of thing that costs more than it really should, you know. You know, I can make a sandwich at home that's probably as good as a lot of deli sandwiches. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, someone's made it for me. I'm out and about. You know, again, I've worked for this money. I deserve this sandwich now rather than having to, you know, cut that difficult loaf of sourdough at home, really saw at it, you know.
I think I have the title for this podcast episode. John Allison can make a sandwich better than any deli in the world.
I think I can. I think I might have a t-shirt made with yes. that on. And people can challenge me.
Moving on. What comics are you reading right now?
Let me have a think. I've been reading of late. I really enjoyed the Ed Piskor, X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it's called. I apologize. I usually have a pile right next to my desk.
Grand Design.
X-Men Grand Design. That's terrible. The book isn't terrible. Me not being able to remember that it's called Grand Design is terrible.
Right.
What did I pick up recently? Gut Ghost by Enzo Garza, which is like, it's on Scout Comics, a company I know nothing about. It's literally a comic about a sheet full of intestines who is a ghost. He's got arms. This book, I haven't spoken to anybody else who's ever read it, so it's very difficult for me to get a bead on why I enjoy it. But it's beautifully drawn. It's very funny. It's really good comics. This is somebody who I think is doing everything himself. So yeah, well worth checking out. Gut Ghost. Gut with two T's.
Yeah, I see now. I just Googled it. I haven't heard of this. Interesting.
It's a great book. This is a great cartoonist.
Yeah.
You know, as I say, he's working for a company I've never heard of. I think they have, you know, a little portfolio of books. It's kind of like a modern slave labor graphics kind of. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Kind of slightly alternative, but you know, with the kind of trappings of professional production.
Right.
By Nick Cagnetti. I've been picking those up. Nice. Real fun books. Again, he's like I think he's a pretty young artist. If not a young artist, he's got a kind of youthful energy to his work in a kind of called Kirby-esque way.
Mm.
Really, really enjoyable. I'm enjoying a lot of the kind of fringe cartoonists who are kind of doing their own thing. Head Lopper by Andrew McLean,
mm-hmm.
I really love. Let me think. I've been picking up like Penelope Bagieux's books. I can't speak French, but some of them are only in French. And I got The Witches, her adaptation of the Roald Dahl book. And that is a beautiful comic. She's amazing. Like that's true effortless cartooning where it takes a lot of practice to make it look that easy. So Bagieux's always really good. I was at the Angoulême Festival in France and I picked up a load of French books, but I'm wearing my headphones and they're all on top of a shelf waiting to be sorted out and I can't reach them or see them, so I apologise.
Oh no, that was a great list so far. Yeah.
So let's see, what else is on my part? I've got the Tom Scioli Grand Design as well.
Uh-huh.
That's a great book. Although I have to say, I wish I'd picked it up in the larger format because he's kind of used certain printing techniques.
Mm.
Kind of, you know, the Tom Scioli kind of muddy style is taken to the absolute limit of what he does with it here, and actually make, I think in a larger format it would be more pleasant to read. But it's so dense. He's doing mm-hmm. 25 panel grids on pages.
It's crazy.
In a standard US comics format, which is, yeah, it's crazy.
Marvel's been doing some Treasury editions lately, like with Silver Surfer Black and the History of the Marvel Universe. They're quite nice to feel in your hands, and the size of it is quite impressive.
Yeah, I mean, Silver Surfer Black, is Trad Moore?
Yes, yep. And Donnie Cates.
Trad Moore's an incredible artist. Like, it's one Amazing. Of the people I think I admire the most working at the moment. Just perfect, different, very modern,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the sort of soup of influences in there. You can't pick it apart and take out exactly what it is. I think Trad Moore's work is breathtaking. So yeah, definitely deserves a Treasury edition. And that's what I've got on my desk.
No, that was a great list. I think people will be reaching out and trying to find some of these because they are. So I don't know if you've heard of Bad Idea, the new publisher.
Yes, I have. Yes.
But it sounds like making it, you know, if a book is difficult to find, possibly there is even more interest for it. At least that's their model, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get my head around the Bad Idea model of scarcity, creating scarcity. And surely the books just have to be good and then people will want to read them.
Surely.
Maybe that's not a bad enough idea.
I'm just worried about the reseller market because people could really get fleeced. If someone buys like seven of them and, you know, turns them over for $50 each.
Oh, yeah. I mean, also these books, how good are these books, these Bad Idea books going to be? Are they going to be the greatest comics ever made? That is what I want to know because, you know, it's like Superman number one is a pretty, I mean, I don't know if you've seen Superman or Action Comics number one. It's not actually that well drawn. You know what? not a patch on work that came kind of 50 years later, to be honest with you.
Right.
But, you know, so but obviously it's a historical artifact, whereas a Bad Idea comic is not a historical artifact. Mm. They just only printed 20. Believe me, I printed books that I only printed 500 of. If anyone wants one of those, $800. I've got plenty of them.
They're going fast. They're so rare. I mean, are Fabergé eggs the greatest eggs on earth? Probably not, but people want them.
No, have you ever seen anybody with a Fabergé egg box? I don't think so.
No, not at all. Okay, that's the end of our interview portion. In our next segment, Super Fight, this is where we challenge two characters based on the card game Super Fight from Skybound Games. This is a way to basically figure out a ludicrous solution to a ludicrous fight. So since Charlotte is a detective, I figure the best detective to pit her against would be Sherlock Holmes. And I'm going to randomly select a card, and we have to determine who would win in this super fight.
Okay.
So the card is, who would win in one of those crazy Japanese game shows?
Oh, you mean like a Takeshi's Castle kind of thing?
With
people dressed in huge sponge foam. Well, Charlotte's no friend of dignity. I mean, she just stomps around like a dinosaur most of the time, whereas Sherlock Holmes is a little more reserved. I think he'd ultimately have the benefit of like his height and his reach, because she's quite small. She's only about like 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. Whereas he's, you know, I think he's a good 6 foot in his, you know, in his sensible shoes. So initially she'd have like the lead, but then Sherlock Holmes with his adults, you know, size and long spindly arms will be able to reach the various sponge foam targets and things like that. She's probably more nimble, but also her diet of sweets and
that's true,
kind of torpid teenage ways would probably work against her.
Yeah, you know, he might be in some sort of shock, whereas she, you know, she's of this world of our time, so she wouldn't be as you know, amazed and perplexed by whatever they throw at them.
Yeah. Plus, he's quite like, Holmes is capable of a punch up, isn't he? A bit of a dust up, I think, if necessary. You know, Marquess of Queensbury rules, you know, with the fists held very high, but he's still, you know, he's got a certain amount of physical prowess that I think she lacks. She's more just a sort of brain on legs.
Also, isn't he a drug user? And Charlotte isn't, I don't think.
No, she steers clear of intoxicants, generally speaking.
Whereas, so maybe that's an edge for him. In some way, I don't know how.
Well, the thing is, I think he's a morphine addict, so he's got a lot of energy. But he only does it between cases. I remember he's not like constantly like going down an alleyway for a fix. It's just true. When he's bored between cases, when he's nothing for his mind to do.
That's a good point.
He hypnotizes himself.
That's a good point.
So that he can, it's a sort of like carbonite freezing situation, I think, for his intellect.
All right, I think we're both in agreement then. Charlotte wins the Japanese game show.
I think so, yeah.
In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, this is your chance to talk about something you're into right now that's not comics related. Could be a TV show, could be something you're into is cooking, a book you're reading, anything like that.
Well, I had a little think about this because I wanted to make sure that I didn't just come up with the first thing that I saw with my eyes.
Yeah,
I've been reading Horror Stories, the autobiography of Liz Phair, the exiling Guyville, etc., 90s singer up to the present day. It's an incredibly well-written book. You know, you're not really surprised that she's a good writer, but the way she couches these kind of terrible anecdotes from her life, and she writes them all like nasty short stories.
Interesting.
So it's a kind of cross between really confessional, autobiography, but also the pacing. And the kind of wit of a real like master short story writer. Yeah, that's a great book. It's an easy read as well. You know, the chapters are short, so you can just kind of plow through a little sort of 15 pager. If you've not got a huge amount of time, or it's a little commute read. Yeah, so Horror Stories by Liz Phair. That's a great book. I've been enjoying an awful lot lately.
It's hard for me to concentrate at all these days. So that's a huge bonus.
Well, I do like reading manga because the chapters are, you know, they're short, so you can just kind of like plow through a chapter. And then I've been reading Bakuman because, you know, I like to read self-reflexive work. Although this is comics, so it shouldn't be allowed to count in this category. I like to be as self-reflexive and solipsistic as possible, so I'm reading a series about two people who make comics.
Oh, okay.
But I just like, because the chapters, the chapter ends, and then you know the chapter because you get to see their name, the little storyboard they make of the of the comic, like the writer's one, and then the thumbnails by the artist underneath it. And I think those are my favorite bits of the book, just seeing how other cartoonists make things. But again, I don't think that's allowed to count because that's common.
You're breaking the rules.
I don't mean to. I don't like to be transgressive. So I hope.
Oh no, no, I'm just kidding.
I hope you won't judge me too harshly.
Those are great. Those are great picks. Do you have anything else?
Let me think. One more thing. We've been rewatching, my girlfriend and I, she's a bit younger than me, and we've been watching, due to the lockdown, but also slightly before that, we're watching The Sopranos from the start, and which was, I watched when it aired on TV here, and I haven't seen it since. So it's that's been an incredible change. I don't know if you've heard about The Sopranos. Pretty good TV series. Generally acknowledged not to be all that bad as these things go. And it's funny to watch the first season and see how young James Gandolfini is. And also, even though when we watched it at the time, it seemed incredibly sophisticated, because it became more sophisticated as it went on, and they kind of refined the format. You watch it like, oh, this is quite loose. Yeah. It seems quite loose compared to what it, how I remember it ending, you know.
Yeah.
So it almost seems that there's an innocence about it at the start. And yeah, that's a treat to watch. Goodness me. The Sopranos, yeah. There's plenty there still, plenty of meat still on that particular bone. I'm definitely enjoying my second go through that.
It's good timing too, because that prequel movie is, or show, I forget which it is.
With the son of Gandolfini.
Yes, that's going to be interesting.
Playing Tony Soprano, yeah, that's great. I should come up with something that isn't old though, so I should think about a sitcom that I've been watching.
I don't know, it's kind of poignant, because also I just finished that new show, High Fidelity, which I loved, and there's a running...
Yeah, the swapped...
Yes.
High Fidelity, yeah.
I was so against it at first because I loved the movie so much, but then it totally sells you on it. And it's a lot more complex than the film because there's more to the side characters. But there's a running like gag in there that the main character hasn't seen Sopranos, and everyone's like, are you crazy? This is, you have to have seen Sopranos. She's also only 30, so she's young too.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You can't hold these things, these old sores over the younger generation. No, you have to acknowledge that, you know, not everybody has seen all the things that you've seen. But seeing it with someone else is often as enjoyable as watching it for the first time if they're really enjoying it. It can sometimes be better, yeah.
That's true. Well, John Ellison, thank you so much for being on the APT Comics podcast. This is a lot of fun. If you don't know, Wicked Things number 1 is out in comic shops now, also digitally on Comixology from Boob Studios. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.